Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 12 of the Fan to Fan podcast, presented to you both by Pro Wrestling Ponderings and Wrestle Folks. Follow both of those groups on Twitter at PW Ponderings and at Wrestle Folks, and be sure to find both of them on iTunes and Stitcher. Subscribe, leave reviews, all that good stuff. Today's guest with me is Kevin Harvey, who, if you are already subscribed to the Pro Wrestling Ponderings feed, you may know him from the Schools In podcast, which airs Mondays, and sometimes there's special bonus episodes sprinkled throughout. He's also a mainstay in the AAW promotion as the manager for the We Are Here faction. He's also been a part of Shimmer Wrestling for many, many years, usually serving as a ring announcer. And we have him on today to talk about the big AAW Shimmer Weekend coming up, as well as the School of Everything Else, which he has started, and of course, a little bit about his career and how he got involved into the world of professional wrestling. A fun conversation between Kevin and I. I guess you can call this episode Kevin to Kevin, more so than fan to fan. So without any further ado, let's get into it. Let's get into my chat with Kevin Harvey. Joining me now is Kevin Harvey, and even though this is a Pro Wrestling Ponderings podcast with Kevin Harvey, I do have to say this is not an episode of School's In. So, Kevin, how's it going?
Things are all right this evening. Just settling in from the real world today. Ready to go to bed, man. I'm kind of tired.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to ruin your evening with a night of podcasting.
It's not exactly foreign territory for me these days.
I always feel like if I do a podcast and someone's like, oh, you know, I'm just tired or something, I'm like, well, don't let me keep you from going on in your real life. And I feel guilty about it.
Hey, that's what I do. I guilt people into things.
Well, I guess that explains how you were able to get your band of misfits together in AEW. But that's neither here nor there.
The system works.
So, Kevin, tell me how you got into pro wrestling.
Oh, it's like a kid watching it or like a dude in it?
Take me back to when you became a fan of professional wrestling.
Oh, that's going back to about 1988, maybe 89. I usually like to say 88 just because it's longer and somehow more relevant, but pretty much WWF household. Like, I was the lone wrestling fan in the family. It was sort of, I think maybe my sisters were flipping through it at the time, and they were probably watching because it was like, ooh, look at these hot guys on wrestling. And I was just like, who's that dude with the tassels on his arms? He's clearly the best wrestler in history.
Yeah, I assume we're talking about the Ultimate Warrior.
Oh, absolutely talking about the Ultimate Warrior.
I was like trying to think, I was like, was there anyone else at the time who wore tassels in WWF who it could have been? But I mean, it had to be the Warrior.
If they did, they didn't wear them nearly as well, but it was just the characters kind of caught my eye. And there was another kid who rode my bus who was a couple of grades younger than me who had the big LJN figures. And I've always been kind of a toy guy all my life. And I was like, man, those are some big figures. I have no idea what those are. And I started talking to him, and I'll never forget him describing the kilted figure as Rowney Roddy Piper.
I don't even know what that nickname would mean.
I'm not entirely sure either, but that I soon figured out that was Rowdy Roddy Piper, who was just coming back shortly after I started watching. So it all started to make more sense.
My time of wrestling was a little bit after the LJN figures, but I was able to get some from yard sales and stuff. I don't know what it was about those, but they would get marks on them like crazy.
Yeah, and the paint would wear off in really strange places, too.
Mm-hmm. And you had those, I don't know why, but I remember my friend had a King Kong Bundy figure that for whatever reason, his spine was colored in with pen. Like, people just love to draw all over those figures, and I still have no idea why.
Well, I think it was just that was how you conceded in trying to keep them in as good a condition as you can. I remember using whiteout on Junkyard Dog's boots.
Just to, like, keep them the right color, or like was the paint peeling and you needed to fill it in?
The paint was peeling off, so I was just filling things in because, like, there was a chunk missing or something. But, man, for as much wear as those figures would have, man, those were fun to play with.
Yeah, they were huge and heavy. Like, you could hit a kid over the head with those things and do some real damage.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for, really, in any toy for a small child.
I know. The thing is now, like, I look at the figures they have today, and, God, they're spoiled. They're so detailed and have all these, you know, articulations in the joints and everything else. Like, as a kid, I would have killed for something like that. But I had to deal with the Hasbros, the plastic guys with the one move. or the guys who could barely move anything or were stuck in a position. Like, what am I going to do with a Hulk Hogan who can do a bear hug? He really can't do much of anything else.
Well, I feel like that's taken some of the creativity away from the kids today, because if you decide, okay, I'm going to have this person in an STF or Regal stretch or something, you can pretty much make the figures do that. Whereas before, it'd be like, how am I going to make Hulkster hug vertical suplex? Ah, damn it. It's one of those spring neck guys with the notch on his back. I can't do anything with this. His legs are stuck together.
Yeah. You're like, oh, how am I going to do a drop kick? I just hold them up vertically and there you go. That's the big difference you could tell, I think, with a kid if they're going to be a wrestling fan or not. If a kid's using his figures to put on STF, good chance he's going to be a fan, but for a while. But if it's just a kid who wants to bash them together or you do chair shots and stuff, well, I mean, that's just kids being kids with toys.
Yeah, they'll figure it out one way or another.
So were you mostly just a WWE fan growing up?
Really, WWF was the only option for me. I grew up in a very rural area of Climax, Michigan. As much as that sounds like a wrestling line, I am legitimately from the town of Climax, Michigan. And WWF was the only thing on. At least if you didn't have cable, it was the only option. And I didn't have any form of cable or satellite because it really wasn't available just in the house that I grew up in until about, I think it was 96. And WWF was on in syndication with Superstars. So about the only wrestling I truly saw were the different, you know, enhancement talent matches and things telling the story on WWF Superstars. I was aware of primetime wrestling, and which later became Monday Night Raw. And I would only see those maybe on special occasions when I happened to be at my Uncle Bob's house on a Monday night.
I do remember watching like Superstars and Mania and those things on Saturdays and always seeing the lower tiered guys, because most of my early wrestling watching was through like Coliseum videos and things like that. And I always wondered why I never saw the main eventers. But even as a kid, like with those enhancement talent matches, or just, you know, when they would bring in like the heavenly bodies or things like that, like I loved it. I couldn't get enough of those kind of guys.
Well, even if you were in limited broadcasts like I was, there would still be things like Saturday night's main event was still pretty hot at that point. It was on NBC, and then later they did a couple of them on Fox, I think. But it was I definitely got my fill, and I was aware of what else would get out there. And then, like you said, Coliseum Video, I'd go to the local grocery store and get WrestleMania 6 or SummerSlam 90 or the different treasures of that era. Occasionally, WCW Worldwide would be on my local ABC channel at like 1:30 in the morning, but it would be so erratic you could never really count on it. I didn't dislike what I saw, and half the time I was confused because I'm like, why's the Barbarian wrestling that guy?
Oh man, you brought up WrestleMania 6 and the Ultimate Warrior. I guess if you're a Warrior fan as a kid, that had to be like a huge, awesome event that you love to watch.
Well, that is probably my all-time favorite WrestleMania for sentimental reasons. Probably the most emotionally invested, because I was right on that line of, okay, I'm a kid. I know it's not necessarily on the up and up in terms of a contest, but it's just really, really cool. And I was definitely on Team Hogan on that particular pay-per-view. But yeah, Warrior, it was just this powerful, colorful character, and granted, I didn't know what the hell he was saying, but he seemed to care so much about it that I wanted to care about it.
Now, but you know, Warrior was kind of out of WWF by 92, so he wasn't around when it was going up into the new generation Attitude Era. Is there someone else that you really connected to, or did you just become a fan of the WWF brand by that point?
It was really the entire WWF company. Like, there, I'd never really assign an absolute label of things like, this is my all-time favorite wrestler. Like, I was definitely a Hogan guy. I've always leaned toward the absurd and the cartoony. I loved like the Bushwhackers, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, just anything that was truly a character was what I probably got into most as a kid. Just remember going to house shows in the local area, doing the Bushwhacker strut around Wing Stadium in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It was just fun. Anything that was fun, I absolutely loved.
I've preached a lot on this show about how much I love characters in wrestling, and that's really what I think, by and large, hooks most people, is when you see these characters on the show. And I was just listening to the other day to Colt Cabana's podcast with The Genius, and The Genius even said, you know, wrestlers without really a character just aren't that fun to watch. And I think sometimes, well, some people kind of forget that, and they get a little too invested in the moves and things like that, which obviously is great. You can tell a great story, but characters really, I think, is really important. I think some people tend to lose sight of that.
it's something that is, it's becoming, I don't want to say a lost art form, but it's becoming harder and harder to find, especially on the independents. Moves are fine and good, but man, I would love a guy in a cap and gown with a scroll reading poetry who does a moonsault kind of out of nowhere in ballet. Like that was so great to listen to. I love the genius as a character. Like, he was somebody I loved to hate when I was, you know, 9-10 years old, when he was kind of in his heyday as a wrestler in WWF. But as you start to learn the art of professional wrestling and you work in it and you travel to different places and see different things, you really get just a finer appreciation for how good somebody was in a role like that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, because the thing that jumps to mind immediately was the Hart Foundation, especially Brett in the USA-Canada Wars. Because I remember as a kid being like so hurt legitimately that this wrestler, who was by and large my favorite at the time and one of my all-time favorites, you know, denouncing America and becoming this heel. And then, like, years and years, as you said, as you go on, you learn the appreciation for wrestling. It just automatically one day clicks in your head, like, oh, man, now I can see how good that was and how good that person was in their role.
Yeah, and when you look at little Sully's, like, Bobby Heenan and how good he was at ringside, not at getting attention on himself, but somehow getting all that weasel heat and putting it on whoever was in the ring.
Yeah, I know this is certainly not an original thought, but I was watching the 92 Rumble the other day, and you know, everyone says it's the best of all time, and everyone talks about the commentary. But just how Heenan could come off as so unlikable, being the guy cheering for Flair the whole time, is really just masterful.
And half the time, why people hated Bobby was because he was right. When you look at all the different anti-Hogan things that Bobby Heenan said over the years, he wasn't wrong. Raking the back is against the rules. Gouging the eyes is against the rules. Granted, the heel would be doing it too, but Bobby would always call out those intricacies. And something to just kind of wrap that all up, when you look at Bobby's commentary during the NWO, the leg drop heard around the world, Hogan's the third man, Heenan's commentary in that, and even the entire time Hogan was a heel, Bobby never faltered from what he'd always said about Hogan for years.
Yeah, he's just absolutely brilliant, which obviously I'd assume had to kind of play a role in, or at least be an influence to what you do as a manager in the wrestling world. So I'll bring it back around and say, what point did you become from a fan to deciding, you know what, this is something I like to do, to be involved in the world of professional wrestling?
It was something that I think I think in life in general, as a kid and in high school, I thought I was working towards something in wrestling. I think it was my sophomore year of high school. They needed somebody to announce. It was either a basketball game or a volleyball game. I forget which came first, the chicken or the egg for that one. But anyhow, I was just like, I can announce. Give me the microphone. So I started doing, you know, Howard Finkel ring intros, and it kind of got over with this high school athletic crowd, and it became a thing. And I thought, all right, I kind of started to figure out what I can do in an announcer role to bring the crowd up and kind of hit the announcements you have to, sponsor things, concession stand plugs, whatever, you know, happens at high school sports. And eventually I finished my freshman year of college, and there was I went to my first ever independent show January of 1999. And it was April of 99 that I actually debuted as the ring announcer for that same promotion when they came back around.
So there was never a point you thought you wanted to be a wrestler, but you wanted to either be a ring announcer or something else.
Yeah, I think anyone would be fooling themselves to think, oh, I never would want to be a wrestler. Like, everyone wants to have that match or that glory or whatever comes along with just being the person in the ring. Realistically, I think I knew I would never be some permanent wrestler. I mean, you can go back and find tapes in the world of god-awful wrestling matches that had me in them from the famed Lakeshore Wrestling Organization from Holland, Michigan, back around the late 90s, 2000, somewhere in there. And it's not like I looked at these things and went, oh my God, this is a great match. It was like, you could kind of, even at the time, I could kind of be humble and say, God, that was not awesome. And it just gets funnier as you get older, just how bad these things were. But I was never an athlete in high school. I was never, like, I think the last organized sport I played was somewhere around seventh grade. I was on a basketball team. And then after that, I just put my focus into other things. And even in grade school, I realized, okay, I'm not going to be the one out there playing basketball, but I can be a part of this game and, you know, in front of these fans and getting cheers and things by taking the microphone and doing something else to put some spotlight on the actual basketball players that are there in that game.
How long were you in Michigan for?
I was in Michigan for the first 22 years of my life.
So, I'm trying to get a range of like what the year it was, because I know a couple of my buddies were roommates with Jimmy Jacobs for a little bit of time, and I remember them talking about, I don't think it was the promotion you discussed, but there was a promotion from Michigan that was on TV for a little bit, and I know that's when he was doing the Jumpin' Jimmy Jacobs character, and I think Sabu was on it, so I don't know if you had any involvement in that around the time. I think it was in the early 2000s.
Yeah, that sounds like it might have been AWWL or maybe a PWF out of Lansing. Mm-hmm. Like that, it was right around, he didn't do much Jumpin' Jimmy Jacobs by the time that was rolling around.
Okay. Because I remember they talked about him and his brother who had the, he had like the math gimmick.
Yeah.
I'm talking about.
Yeah, he was different characters over time. At that point, he was the evil Dr. Numbers, Bobby Bambino.
Yes, Bobby Bambino.
A lot of his career, he was known as the Blitzkrieg Kid. But yeah, he and his brother, both Blitzkrieg Kid and Jimmy Jacobs, they were both an integral part of LSWO. But whatever it was, like I ran around a lot with those guys. In fact, my first ever out-of-state trip from Michigan was in a van with Jimmy Jacobs, Bobby Bambino, and Mama Jacobs Bino. I'm not sure how that would work out.
Where was that to?
That was to Platteville, Wisconsin.
Okay. I feel like there's this whole indie scene up in that area that really doesn't get a lot of internet exposure that a lot of people just aren't privy to unless you're from that area.
Yeah, and looking back on it, like I had a lot of fun on some of those shows, and a lot of those shows were, you know, kind of crucial experience and learning points and things, but it's probably for the better that a lot of those shows had more limited exposure. The term shindy comes to mind.
Oh, well, you know, I guess it's those places where you can make your mistakes and have some learning experiences, and not too many people will have to bear witness to it.
Yeah, you know, and you figure out kind of how the world works and how things work. You know, every show can't be a Shimmer taping. Every show can't be a Ring of Honor iPay-per-view. You know, there's far, far, far more just hole-in-the-wall shows with maybe a hidden gem of a match and a lot of crap than there are just five-star cards.
Absolutely. And did you mostly just start out doing ring announcing in the beginning?
Yeah, I did almost exclusively ring announcing right up until probably, that was probably like 2005 when I really started doing other things, like delving more into commentary. Like I've always done commentary here and there, but never necessarily a steady commentary gig. Where I got probably my most like exposure and just, you know, constant work was actually for a now defunct place. It was called the Hardcore Wrestling Federation, which for as generic of a name as that was, it was a really unique product. Like they would run larger venues throughout Ontario. Like they actually would run places like the London Ice House, which was, I think its claim to fame was that was where Tito Santana and Greg Valentine had the cage match where the Intercontinental title changed hands. So we were actually running venues like the London Ice House, and not necessarily sellouts, but they weren't exactly, you know, fans dressed up as chairs, as Ed Schumann used to love to say. Yeah, I would run around. I would do mostly ring announcing for HWF. When I first started there, they were they filmed a TV pilot of some kind. And I think that just got continually shopped around and never really went anywhere. But it had a really loyal following. There was a special on it on CBC, which is a Canadian television network. Sort of like, I might not be a fair comparison, maybe like a CBS or an NBC here in the United States. And so there was a lot of media exposure and a lot of fans, and it would be a formula of, you know, a name or two, but they had a lot of the talent of the HWF would go on to be sort of the first wave of TNA.
I was kind of thinking, because I've had commentators on, I've had wrestlers on, obviously there's a lot of tapes to study and people you can talk to about that, but ring announcing, there's really, I don't know, I just feel like there's not a lot of studying you can do except for like maybe, I don't know, watching Howard Finkel. What did you do when you got in there? What would you do to prepare to be the best ring announcer you could possibly be?
Well, essentially what most ring announcers do, and was certainly the case for me for a number of years and probably still a large case today when I do step into the ring from time to time to do the in-ring announcing. Howard was my gold standard. his pacing, just everything, especially as the business evolved from no music to maybe a third of the guys get music to music and pyro and all the craziness. Like, he always was able to still be Howard and get that, you know, give a great introduction to people as they were coming to the ring. And I think so much of that comes from timing, that it's something that it's almost impossible, I feel like, to get that without someone actually pointing it out to you or sort of being in the middle of the ring and feeling things out. Because it's, I found a key thing was memorization, because you just kind of feel and look like a goof if you're trying to read the cards. Plus, if you're reading the cards, you aren't paying attention to where somebody's at necessarily. And it's something that I think I had a good idea of the formula of ring announcing. I mean, everybody kind of knows, like, all right, when somebody comes out on Monday Night Raw, they say he's from a town, he weighs this much, and maybe he has a nickname, and this is his name. Like, it's not hard to figure that part out. It's where you put that stuff and how you inflect it and how you pace it out over the course of a show.
I think there's also something to be said for a guy like Howard Finkel. As I remember watching as a kid, everybody seemed like a superstar, and a lot of it had to do with the way that Howard Finkel would introduce them or put a certain inflection on their nickname or some attribute that, like that, that, as again, if you're not very astute, you wouldn't really notice it, but it's something that you would perceive even if you didn't know it. And I know there are certain commentators on the indies who I feel do a really good job of, when a guy comes out and they're talking about a nickname or something like that, you get an idea of who that person is before they even get into the ring and start doing something.
Well, yeah, and any announcer's job is to make the people in the ring more important than themselves.
Absolutely. I think that's really anybody's job who's not a wrestler is what they should be. You know, the commentators aren't there to put themselves over. They're there to put the wrestlers over. Same with the ring announcers, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, you know, there's a lot of things. And again, I feel like commentators get taken for granted, but ring announcers really get taken for granted, because, again, there's indie shows where people kind of just say who's coming out, and it's not very exciting, and the person there seems pretty disinterested in what's going on, and it really does take the tone of the show down.
Well, yeah, and especially with the appearance of ring announcers, a lot of times they might not, you know, I'm not saying everybody's got to be in a top hat and tails, but if you go out there, and just like for wrestlers, if you go out there and you look like everybody that's in the audience, why is anybody going to pay attention to anything that guy has to say?
Right, and I think something else valuable that they add is they're the first person that the crowd hears at the show. You know, they're the ones who introduce everything. They're the ones who set the bar. They set the energy level. They keep things going as guys are heading to the back, or as you're going from match to match, or coming back from a promo, something of that nature. So I think it's actually pretty hard. Was there ever a really challenging moment or a learning experience you had as a ring announcer that came to mind?
Well, in terms of challenges, something that if you're doing only ring announcing and you're working for all these different promotions, it's always challenging whether you want to be or not. You have to come to terms with the fact that you're the face of that particular wrestling brand. Unfortunately, a fan can't necessarily differentiate an IWA from an AAW from an AWA from this and that. If it's not WWE, they just see wrestling on the poster, and depending on where you're working, there were situations where I was basically had to flat out go lie to the fans about why so-and-so wasn't here. I learned that you kind of had to hit the negative, like you had to do it, but then just try to get as close as you can to the positive as quick as you can. And it's never easy to do that. It's sort of a moral dilemma too, because you're like, that's not what happened, but all right, I'm going to go say that.
Right. It's like, you have to be the bearer of bad news. It's the booker or the promoter is not coming out there to explain to it. The wrestler themselves isn't going to get on the phone and explain to the people. You have to be the one to tell them, hey, you know, this guy you paid money for, yeah, they're not showing up. Sorry, but we still are going to have a good show. We promise.
Well, yeah. And it's kind of a hard spot too, because sometimes, you know, no shows or flights or things happen with WWE, you know, transportation can be a problem. But if you're in WWE, it's really easy to give another name that somebody does know. So you might be able to say, Brodus Clay will not be here tonight. Oh, boo, my kids wanted to see him dance. But we do have Zack Ryder. All right, Zack Ryder's a good guy. And you kind of get a pop from it. But on the indies, if you have something like, Tatanka is not here tonight. Boo. But we do have Gene Miller.
Right. Yeah, that's... It's a bit tough, because I'm especially with someone like a Tatanka, if he's the only person on the card that a family knows, they're not going to be happy. And you really got to convince them to stay or not ask for a refund. I figure they're probably the hardest people to get to stick around.
Yep. That's the casual fan that you want to get. You know, you want them to fall in love with Gene Miller or Jason Cronin or whoever your independent talent might be. But if that's the, you know, quote, only reason they came, then they're going to be disappointed right off the bat.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of tough to keep them around. But let me ask you, as a ring announcer, what's something that once you took on the role that you didn't realize was a valuable part of the job that maybe just a fan watching at home wouldn't really understand?
It's hard to say for a fan watching at home to get this, because this doesn't happen so much in the television world because there's so many directors and producers calling the shots. On a live event, like on an independent show or even on a house show for WWE, it's the pacing of the show. You can't necessarily announce, in my mind, the very first match with the same inflection and the same importance as the main event. Like, you've got to make each part of that show feel different. And you've got to build the event as it builds toward whatever your main event or your draw is for that night. You've got to actually maintain energy, too. It's pacing a show is an incredibly difficult thing to truly master, to the point where you aren't rushing people out of the ring, but at the same time, you aren't dragging things down, because a ring announcer getting in the ring quickly after wrestlers are out can be the difference between a 2.5 hour show and a 2-hour, 45-minute show.
And so I know you do ring announcing for Shimmer and a bunch of other different places, but the first time I ever really get to see you was, I think, as your managerial role in AAW. And how did you decide, or did you decide, to make the transition from being not just a ring announcer, but being a manager as well?
I dabbled in managing around 2005, 2006, somewhere in there for IWA Mid-South. And I can be honest with myself, I was god awful at that point. There was a transition where I ended up in AAW and there wasn't necessarily a spot for me, but Dan was like, we'll figure something out. And I did backstage interviewing, ring announcing, commentary. I did the you know, fake boss of the company routine for a while. And all those things ultimately built toward being a manager. I feel like we could get to a point where I could be a manager or be a different character on the show, but it took us a long time to find the right place, right time, with the right people, because when you're heavy on really talented managers, the last thing you need is to maybe roll the dice on let's see if Kevin can, you know, do something with these guys, when you already have tried and true and proven talents like Truth Martini, Joey Eastman, Dave Prazak. Like, the AEW wasn't short for managers for a lot of that run.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a crowded scene with the House of Truth and DP Associates and stuff, but I feel like, especially now when I watch some of the promos that AEW puts up on their YouTube channel or that they have on their DVDs, when you see, you know, good promos from a lot of the wrestlers, but then you get to you and your We Are Here group, and I think, this is something different. This is something that stands out. This is something that I really want to keep my eyes on.
Well, and that's what we really wanted to do with it, is to have it be character-driven, to have it be people that are there for a reason, because, we're going against the company has been done. You know, people could throw a rock at us and say, you're copying this, you're copying that. Well, guess what? A bunch of people got together and had a problem with another group of people is pretty much the root cause of professional wrestling. That's how this whole thing kind of started, was bad guy, good guy, difference of opinion, fight. Here we go. And you don't want to just try to be the next New World Order or the next D-Generation X. Like, you've got to take, you know, different things you found from that work. But we wanted to, you know, our common grounds, we had a problem with the company, but we couldn't just go out there every time and do the company is evil. Like, it took a couple months for us all to kind of gel together and to find out who we were, not just with the group, but sort of as individuals as part of that group too.
Yeah. And I think the thing you say about there being the bunch of these groups whose goal is to take down the company kind of being overdone, it is unfortunate, because there was a time where it felt like every major indie company had that going on. But at the same time, I do feel like We Are Here was a little different. It feels like every one of them, honestly, was a little bit different from everybody else. But again, I think the group is strong. I think you provide a good backbone for them as their manager. And again, it's something that sticks out as being drastically different from everything else that's going on in the card. And I definitely think you could see in you a comfort level out there with talking and connecting with the crowd. Do you feel like ring announcing helped you do that?
ring announcing did help with that. I'll tell you, the biggest thing that helped out for the eventual heel turn was doing that year, whatever it was, as the, what we call it, was the COO, where I was the face of AAW. And, you know, I'll joke and say it was the fake boss. Like, I had no money invested in the company. I was involved in some of the decisions and creative end of things. Like, I had some input, but I think we all know, like, Danny, Mike, and Jim are sort of the backbone of the majority of what goes on at AAW, with some help now from, like, Tony Rican and PJ Drummond. Like, those guys do a great job. But to have that year of, for all intents and purposes, being the face of AAW to those fans and shaking hands and kissing babies. And, you know, I would do what Jim would do. Like, I would meet him at the front door. I would give the rah-rah speech before the first match would come out. I would go out there, you know, for key decisions and whatnot. And for the most part, my decisions were either the right decision or decisions that would be there to, you know, pop the fans. And then when it came time, we knew there would come a time that Jim would come back and we'd have to do something else with me. And as that time, like, Jim came back, and there was a month or two where it was just kind of like, okay, I don't know what the heck I'm supposed to do. So I kind of told Danny, I don't think this is going to work. And we decided, I think I told him in April or May, I said, you know what, why don't we just have Jim fire me? Like, we can figure something else out in time and I can come back. But, like, I'm not having fun with this. And to a degree, it was probably being a whiny bitch. But at the end, I like to think that it worked out to AEW's advantage, too, to have something different on their show. So there was, like, a public firing with Jim and me in May. And then I think it was the end of August, all of us returned, or all of us came. We were there by that point.
I think there is something to be said that you talk about going to them and saying, hey, you know, this isn't really working out. I think there's a lot to be said for, as a talent, recognizing this isn't working, or, you know, maybe this company just isn't a good fit right now. Maybe there's some value to me going away and then coming back and doing some good, some better for both of us. Because really, it sounds like at the time you're kind of reaching a point of stagnancy, and going away was probably the best thing for both AAW and for you as well.
Yeah, because I feel like just as much as the, you know, authority figure, especially heel authority figure, can kind of be played out, so can people feuding for control of the company and things of that nature. Like, even looking back at, what was it, 2002, like, Flair and Vince were fighting for control of Raw and different things like that. And I couldn't think of a really different way to do that. And I hadn't really done anything heel-ish. Like, I had done some things that people might question my decision, like suspending Ryan Boz, but at the end of the day, following the rule book, like, I'd done the right thing to a degree. It may have disappointed people, but I did something that would be sensible. And then May, I just kind of had a meltdown on there were just a couple of fans in particular that I picked out, and then Jim was just like, you know what, I never liked you and canned you. And there's a lot of linear things if you go back, and this is probably me overthinking what goes into the different characters that I'm working with, but there's a lot of linear things that led up to, you know, the We Are Coming vignettes, and ultimately, okay, we are here, like, let's do this, and then kind of where things went after that.
So you mentioned that you had never really done anything heelish in the company of AAW, but you come back and introduce this new character, and I think there's a lot of value in looking the part. And obviously, I think if somebody looks at Kevin Harvey, the one thing that jumps out to them more than anything else is the facial hair, the evil-looking facial hair. Is this something that you walk around with in real life, and do you have any interesting encounters with real-life people, and I'm putting that in quotes, that are worth sharing?
Not so much, because there's essentially a trick, and I'll probably spoil some of the magic for people here. I do not go around the general world, you know, in the however many weeks between an AAW event with, you know, three stripes or whatever god awful thing I put on my face. But truth be told, where the beard started was the last time AAW fans saw me when I was still the COO, but I was with Jim and whatnot. When I sort of flipped my wig, I was like shaving my head, like with a number one or a number two guard. So I basically had kind of fuzzy head, clean shaved face. And since that was the way they last saw me, I thought, I want to look as completely opposite as what I did that day as I can. And so I decided to go skin bald, and I grew out my beard for like the 5 or 6 weeks before we ultimately were supposed to do the debut show. And then that evolved to, okay, I just had a full beard for a show or two. And then I thought, you know what? It might be easier to get heat if I just kind of look stupid. So essentially what happens after every AAW show or the day of an AAW show, I'll come up with different ideas. And I try not to repeat, at least since November, I don't think I've repeated any beards in that time. But I'll think about what's the story we're trying to tell, what facial expressions am I going to make, and actually try to outline my face in ways that call out those facial expressions more, make it look bigger, make it look more exaggerated. I have to do a lot of sneering and stuff, so that's where the like middle of the mustache and just the edge of the lip kind of beard or mustache, the Klingon beard kind of came into play. But that's where that comes from. And then after any AEW show, I basically just scorch the earth, shave my whole face, grow out the whole beard, and then the day of the show or the day before, cut it into whatever I want to cut it into.
That's kind of what I figured, because I know one of the wrestlers on the knees I know is he goes by Jocka now, Johnny Mengway. He has a gimmick now where he shaves half of his head and half of his beard. And I got to imagine he just does that the day of the show and then shaves the rest of his head and beard and then goes out in the real world like a person. So that makes sense. That's unfortunate. I was hoping maybe there was an old granny at a grocery store getting terrified by the satanic looking Kevin Harvey story out there.
Sometimes there can be awkward moments because I may have to make stops before or after the show at restaurants and things. So I definitely get some looks sometimes if I maybe making a run for something I need for the show on my way to the Eagles Club or out at a restaurant after the show. You get some interesting looks sometimes.
Hey, but you know what? You gave that person at the sandwich shop something to talk about with their coworkers for the rest of the night.
Exactly. I made their lives better.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite moment in your as part of managing We Are Here that sticks out? I know you've worked with Carlito and Michael Elgin and some other great people.
There's been a lot of really fun moments. I think probably my favorite one overall was not so much even the match itself. Like the match itself was a lot of fun, but it was back in, I think it was February. It was a Bourbon Street show and it was a 6-man street fight. It was a Bourbon Street fight. It was Lamar, Keith, and Tweak with me and Nikki against Ryan Boz, Marion Fontaine, and Darren Corbin. And the thing that I really liked about that is I kind of felt like something's missing, or I feel like we could maybe present this a little bit better, even straight off the bat. And we switched the music that night. So we switched from this like goofy, like string thing that I was using from the Requiem for a Dream soundtrack. And Marcus Crane actually gets the credit for finding the entrance music for this little band of rebels. And we switched to the music, and at the Bourbon Street venue, you know, a couple hundred people, whatever it was, the lights, the fog and everything, like it just felt like we were all stars coming down that ramp. And like, we'd kind of built up to that moment, and then to ultimately win that match and like just one of the crazier fights that's ever happened in that building with AEW. And that bar is set pretty high for that. And to have like, you know, Danny and Mike both be really, really happy with the way that crazy all over the building brawl went, like that's where I felt like things really started to kind of come into their own for the group as being something more than just maybe a novelty or something different, like maybe being a bit more contenders in AEW.
Yeah, that was actually a really good match going all around that building. Was that in, I can't remember, was that in the Berwyn Eagles Club?
That was Bourbon Street.
That's what I thought. I was like, I don't remember being in Berwyn, but maybe not, because I actually got a chance to go to Berwyn for the first time this past May, and it's a really cool little venue there. What do you think of the Berwyn Eagles Club?
The Berwyn Eagles Club is great for that level of wrestling. Like it's very much like a, maybe even more intimate, like an old studio Saturday morning TV taping kind of thing. Like everybody's kind of packed on top of each other. It always looks full. You know, when the crowd comes to their feet, you can see everybody on the camera, and even watching things on DVD or VOD through SmartMark Video, you really get a good feel for what's going on in that building. Like there's not really a bad seat in the house. There's all the views are unobstructed as far as I know. Like it's a solid building to watch and to perform wrestling.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, I think aside from AEW, most people would probably identify you being involved with Shimmer Women Athletes also, which runs the majority of their shows there. And they're going to be having some tapings coming up very, very soon. Were you involved with Shimmer from the very beginning?
not from the very beginning. Like, I've been friends with Dave for many, many years. Like, he was on some of my earliest events that I had in Michigan where I was ring announcing, and he'd be managing like Cabana or Punk or different people that might come up from Chicago. Ace Steel would be in that group certainly as well. And it was probably, it was right after I joined AEW, so probably 2006 when I really became like a regular fixture, just showing up to help out however I could at for Shimmer. It was, I think, volume 16. Joey couldn't make it, so I stepped in and did ring announcing for somewhere in the late teens. I think it was volume 15 and 16, maybe 16 and 17. And really from that point forward, haven't missed a taping.
Yeah, so you've been around because they're about to do volumes 58 through 61 coming up soon. All those tapings in the Berwyn Eagles Club. Shimmer's such a unique group because I feel like right now there's a lot of women's wrestling groups right now, but Shimmer seems to really be the cream of the crop, and there's been so many great matches and so many great wrestlers and names who have passed through. Do you have a favorite Shimmer match or moment that sticks out in your mind?
I think probably my favorite Shimmer moment favorite from a fan's perspective and least favorite from a testicular perspective is probably the first time that the team known as the Night Dynasty made their entrance, because Rebecca Knox came through, big reaction for the return. So that was really cool to see Shadows of the Night pumping through the Berwyn Eagles Club. And then when I see then known as Brittany Knight and Saraya Knight come through the curtain, and I just saw it was something that I can pinpoint that as a moment where it's like, all right, there's two time frames before that happened and after that happened. Wrestling fans saw a lot at Shimmer and a lot of great things, but they'd never seen anything like what they were seeing and what they were about to see and what they've seen over the last, gosh, it's been at least 2, if not 3 years since that debut.
I've listened to all of your episodes of the Schools In podcast, and you've had a lot of the Shimmer athletes on lately, and you always have some great stories outside of the ring. And I got to ask about Shimmer after parties, because those seem to always come away with a lot of stories. What if you had to pick one moment from those Shimmer after parties that really sticks out, something that's worthy of sharing, what would that be?
Oh, man, so much of this might fall under the what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas umbrella.
Sure.
I think one thing that I always enjoyed for a while, the after parties were at the now defunct 3910 Lounge. I had a lot of fun there. I think all the girls had fun there, too. Like, that was a great little place. I think the business just went belly up, or they got another venture or something. Anyway, it's not there anymore. And it was a weird mix because it was a club. So you'd have the Shimmer fans, which for the most part are very safe, very loyal, very, you know, people that just admire the talents and want to get autographs and have quick conversations, maybe snap a picture, and very, very respectable. But you're also mixing in like club douches into this environment. And so we're out on the dance floor, and I'm out there just, for the most part, making a complete ass of myself. I will never claim that I can dance. Never in a million years. And there's videos, I think Lee Burton, that son of a gun, got a video of me, you know, doing some dance off with Madison Eagles. But what I was really doing was trying to keep eyes out for the girls. If guys started creeping on them, I would just like lean real close or grab their arm similar for like an Irish whip and go, reverse this. And they'd look at me like, what the hell? And then when we'd switch, they'd realize I was helping them get away from some guy who was like trying to smell their hair or just some awful creeper thing.
Well, if I'm a guy at a bar and I see, you know, 30 women walking, I'm going to be like, what in the world is going on? Especially if they're all professional wrestlers. That's just something you don't see every day.
Yeah, it's got to be interesting to be the rest of the world when something like that happens. It's normal to any of the Shimmer roster. It's normal to those of us behind the scenes that kind of help get the girls from point A to point B. But it's got to be interesting being that bartender and going, what the hell?
Yeah, there's times where I'm at a wrestling show and something will happen either in the show or not on the show. And I'll think, you know, I think anywhere else in society, this would be very much questioned by everybody else. But in here, it just feels like just another day.
Yep. Another day at the office with my friends from Tokyo, UK, Canada, and wherever else.
And that really is the beauty of professional wrestling, isn't it?
It is. Like, where else in the world or what other job can you say, I'm going to get paid to hang out with my friends from like other continents and I don't have to buy a plane ticket?
Nowhere. I can't think of anything.
I got to drive 23 miles from home to see my friends from Bacchus Marsh, Australia.
It's a charmed life you lead, my friend.
Somebody's got to do it.
Absolutely. Earlier, we were talking about how I feel like you're very comfortable with your character and talking on the mic and et cetera, et cetera. Conversely, we also talked about how there's been kind of a lack of characters, it seems, on the indies. So, sort of a lost art, something that you seem to recognize, and you've created this school of everything else, which is, as it sounds like, it's a wrestling class that focuses on everything else that doesn't really take place in the ring with holds and whatnot. What inspired you to do this?
The inspiration for the school of everything else, or the C, I'll probably use both of those interchangeably as we talk about it. It really came from identifying what seemed to be a lot of businesses would probably call it gap management. Like, there's a number of places you can go to take your money and teach you wrestling, or at least half of that in some cases. But so many of them, they always revert. Like, if there is a ring, people want to bump around. They want to work on wrestle, when so much of what separates you from the pack isn't the move that you do in the ring. And so much of what might get you to catch the eye of somebody on a grander scale is probably an it factor. It's an everything else. I can watch 100 people do a body slam. It's a challenge for any one of those to make me really care about that body slam. And it's something that almost every proper wrestling school out there in the world is going to say, oh, we'll give you all the tools you need to get to WWE, TNA, ROH, whatever it might be, whatever the tagline is. And like, I'm no promises here. Like, I'm not going to tell you I'm the best. I'm going to tell you that I'm going to give any feedback that I can and do these lessons in the interest of making people better, it being more of a total package. No discredit to Lex Luger.
Absolutely not. You do not want to disparage the great name of Lex Luger. But I feel like, yeah, there's so many times where I'm watching a show and there's a guy who I say, man, he's got all the tools in the ring and everything else, but oh man, if he was only just a little bit better on the mic, or if he had better presence or could connect with the crowd better, just those little things, those little tiny things, I think make a world of difference. And I think it's actually kind of amazing that there hasn't been an idea like this out there before. That's really more of a school for people to work on these sort of things, because again, there's a lot of wrestling schools and a lot of really good wrestling schools around the country and around the world where you can go and get trained properly. But some of those things that don't come naturally, certain people, like promos or characters or thing like that. Again, I'm just stunned that there isn't a bunch of different schools for everything else out there.
Well, and the truth is there's not a giant market for it, because I've advertised, you know, a number of these camps at this point, because I started the concept, like announced it in July sometime, in the first camps, I think we're at the beginning or maybe middle of August. And I've had some that I've been well attended. I've had some where not a soul has contacted me, because it's ultimately on the different people in wrestling to realize I might need this variety of training. It's sort of a word of mouth. Like, I didn't think it was instantly going to be let's quit your day job and now I can completely rest my laurels on the living I make from the school of everything else. Like, that's just not realistic. But you know, it's kind of disappointing when I say, you know, there's been some interest in the upcoming camp with Saraya Knight, but when you look at it on paper and say widely respected veteran, if not legend status of 23 years from the United Kingdom, the matriarch of basically the royal wrestling family of the United Kingdom, will be in the United States for one day only and doing this training camp. Like, I would hope I've got like 150 emails once that announcement starts to get out there. But in reality, I've had a couple inquiries, but I would love for that just to take off, because where else are you going to get that? Where else can you sit under the learning tree and learn about how to portray yourself as a character, or how to pull the strings and literally puppet the crowd anywhere you want them to go, from somebody who's proven herself to be the gold standard of that lately?
I feel like, and just watching as an outsider, it seems to me like wrestling, you get as much out of it as you put into it. I feel like the guys who do the best and rise to the top, they're the ones who are going to multiple wrestling schools to get training. They're going to the clinics. They're going to the seminars. They're putting their name out there. They're sending in YouTube matches or things to different wrestling companies. They're the ones who are willing to travel X amount of miles and hours to a show that maybe they're not even booked on, but they can travel and shake some hands and get their names out there. So I feel like the same people who might be coming to travel to school of everything else that understand that they maybe need a little bit of polish, a little bit of help to raise their stock, are the same guys who, you know, a few years ago are driving to the William Regal camps and the and things of that nature. So again, I think it's just a matter of, if you really care about wrestling, and if you're very serious about making it your career or just being a better wrestler, this is something perfect that doesn't exactly, it has nothing to do with what's in the ring, but it's all about presentation and how to make yourself just, maybe it'll help you stick out a little bit more.
Yeah, and you know, there's some pretty high names from the independents that have been recently signed to WWE, and I don't know exactly what they're doing in the developmental center, but I'll wager a lot of their time isn't spent perfecting the springboard moonsault.
No, I mean, how many times have we seen they have the promo classes and some of those get leaked onto the internet? But again, the fact that they have an entire class, like it seems like, I think maybe one night a week, that's dedicated specifically just to promo says a lot.
Yeah, and even just little stuff like facial expressions. Facial expressions mean so much, and so many people don't do them. The facial expression is, oh shit, what's the next move?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and certainly, and it's one of those things where, I don't know if independent wrestlers notice, but we as fans, we notice it. We notice the little things, and we really appreciate them. And we also know if you're just kind of going through the motions out there, it's very obvious. So I think there's a lot of value in something like this. What's the feedback for the School of Everything Else been so far from those who have attended?
So far, those who've attended have, at least to my face, had nothing but nice things to say. And I've seen different things like tweets and Facebook posts and things like, oh, I just did this camp with the School of Everything Else, and it was great. The most popular one so far was when I did announcer's camp. Actually, Jerome from pwponderings.com was in that camp. So he's somebody you could probably find out from firsthand who had good things to say. And, you know, he's done a little bit of commentary, but laid out that class was almost exclusively on commentary and ways to kind of build the match and tell the story and different elements of that. That, you know, I'm not going to say I'm the greatest commentator ever. I can tell you my perspective and things that I know from little teases I've had from different companies over the year and feedback that I've gotten from some pretty high places. Like, I can just give you my opinion. I can give you some feedback and give you ideas, and you can run with it however you want. God knows the world doesn't need any more of me running around, but if somebody can take some of my ideas and apply them to their own style, hey, hopefully it can make them better somehow.
So if I'm somebody who's going to be in the area and wants to go to these schools, what can I expect from coming to the School of Everything Else, one of the sessions?
Well, it's going to vary from session to session a bit, because I don't want to get in a rut of doing the same thing every time, or worse, taking somebody's money to do more or less the same speech each time. The camps or the sessions, I use those terms kind of interchangeably. They vary every time out. Like we did announcer's camp, which was a focus on commentary with little bits on ring announcing and interviewing. We have the master. The next one coming up is October 18th. That's master's class in character. What I'm calling our master's classes are anytime I have a guest facilitator. So with that, the depth of the course certainly gets a little bit deeper. And the guest facilitator, you know, the price is going to go up. That's because I'm bringing in somebody with exponentially more experience than I am to hopefully get somebody to learn some things. So master's class character is coming up. I would love to do one that's nothing but the art of the in-ring promo, because it's so different from doing a backstage tape. Like, when you're in the ring, you don't have a stop button. You don't have a redo. And there's ways that you can control the audience with body language. Like, a lot of the in-ring promo goes beyond what you're saying. It's how you say it, when you say it, what are you doing with your body, how are you holding the microphone. So it's, the topics are going to vary from session to session.
And as you said, the next session is this Friday with Soraya Knight from Shimmer, the master's class. That night is going to be AAW, where you're going to be a part of, and you'll be a part of the Shimmer tapings that Saturday and Sunday, tapings 58 through 61. So if you're interested in getting your fix of Kevin Harvey, you got a lot of chances to do so.
Man, I'm going to want to turn Kevin Harvey off after all that.
And it's all in one place, too, so you can just set up a tent or sleep in your car. You may not smell very good, but you can at least go to all these shows in one convenient place. So, listen, this is one of those weekends where I wish I was a Midwest local, because I get my a massive wrestling fix in one weekend with some really great wrestlers. And, you know, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah, a lot of stuff going on October 18th, 19th, and 20th. You can find out everything at AAWrestling.com and ShimmerWrestling.com as far as the events and purchasing tickets and different DVDs and stuff of past events. Smart Mark Video as well for all your AAW stuff. Twitter at AAW Pro, Shimmer at Shimmer Women. Learn everything you can, because it's going to be a heck of a 3-day run. 5 events over 3 days, and probably in the neighborhood of about 60 pro wrestling matches.
And that Berwyn building's pretty awesome. It's a great atmosphere. So if you've never been, go be raucous, be rowdy in the good way, and just have a good time experiencing pro wrestling. Because we're all fans here. That's all we really want at the end of the day.
Yeah, you got to like what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Got to like what you're watching. And I think there's going to be something for everybody to like. You know, AEW is certainly in rated R environment. Shimmer is a family show. You're going to see different ends of the spectrum all the way around.
And you did a phenomenal job plugging all those companies and their social network. But please, Kevin Harvey, where can we get in contact with you?
Well, best things that I'm going to plug for my own selfish purposes right now, the all-purpose central hub for news on the School of Everything Else and the subsequent Schools In podcast. Got a Facebook page, facebook.com/cwrestling. That's S-E-E wrestling. It's almost like I've done this before. You can send me an email if you have any questions on the school, cwrestling@gmail.com. Have a phone number for anybody who has inquiries about the School of Everything Else, 630-708-6733. I'm not the most picky person in who I pick on Facebook for personal friends. If you look for Kevin Harvey and there's a sinister looking bald man, you probably got the right account. And then Twitter, I am at Kevin Harvey AAW.
Yeah, and I can tell people you can listen to the School's In podcast here at pwponderings.com. That drops every Monday. Occasionally, you did a special episode with Soraya Knight that dropped last Wednesday. And I can say is I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I don't even get a chance to listen to a lot of my own shows, nor everything else on PW Ponderings, but I always make it a chance to listen to all those Schools In podcasts because the guests are interesting, and I think you do a really good job with it.
Well, I appreciate that, and Schools In is a vital part of the School of Everything Else. You know, it's obviously one part glorified commercial and communication vehicle for what I've got going on with the school, but the guests, I try to steer clear of the token, like, wrestling questions of who trained you, your first match, and all these things. I think there's something to learn from everybody that I'm going to have on Schools In, or there's another layer to their story that maybe you haven't heard in at all, or maybe in that way before. Got some interesting people lined up for the next couple of episodes. Got some reasonably high names in the world of independent wrestling, and maybe higher than that, but I don't want to get the cart too far ahead of the horse. But you can get it at pwponderings.com. You can also subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. But we've got a new episode every week. It's hard to believe I'm already at episode 14 this week.
It feels like it was just added to the PW Ponderings podcasting network the other day, and here you are, 14 episodes later, still going strong. Haven't missed an episode. That's a good sign, because sometimes, you know, oh, you'll fall off a week or things happen, but you've remained consistent.
I challenge anyone to find another podcast that's going to have Matilda the Hun in all her glory.
Seriously. You know what's funny is I'm fairly young, so I missed all of that glow stuff. So hearing the episode with her and Little Egypt, it really opened my eyes to this wrestling organization that I knew existed, but outside of, oh, Ivory used to be a member, I knew nothing about. So it was really cool listening to their stories. And I will definitely check out the Glow documentary at some point, because after listening to those, and I think it was Little Egypt on the Steve Austin show, I was like, this is something I got to watch.
Yeah, it's a good time. I know Jerome just watched it too. That's just such an interesting documentary. Obviously, I have a pretty vested interest in professional wrestling, specifically women's professional wrestling, especially these days. And Glow's an important part of that, for better or worse, depending on who you talk to. In my mind, for the better, love me some Glow.
You know what? There's one last thing I'm going to ask you to plug. Can you talk a little bit about Indie Wrestling Night over at the Squared Circle?
Yeah, every Wednesday night at the Squared Circle, that's 2418 North Ashland in Chicago for anybody in the Chicago area or in the Midwest. That's Lisa Marie Varon's restaurant. You probably remember her as Victoria in WWE or Tara from TNA. And she's usually right there alongside everybody else having a good time watching and talking wrestling. Every Wednesday night is indie night. There may be different guests, or as I think I've kind of coined the phrase, esteemed dignitaries of the Chicago independent scene. And you never know who's going to pop by. I was actually just there last night, which was Monday. We'll see how that lands during the time warp. Monday night of this week, Karma was there. Amazing Kong, Awesome Kong, Karma, however you know her. Went out and Dave and I went down to say hi to our buddy Kong last night. And indie night every Wednesday. You can watch, talk, and interact with a lot of different people from the independent scene.
Yeah, I had the fortunate occurrence of being able to go to the Squared Circle when I was in Chicago in May. And I got the pizza wontons, and they were absolutely exceptional. And Lisa Marie Varon was around. She was so nice. She was chatting with everybody, made sure everybody felt at home and had everything they needed. So not only is it a great restaurant with really good people on staff, you get to watch some independent professional wrestling. It's basically the best place on the planet Earth is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and you can check out, they've got a really great menu. I'm partial to the burgers. I like those best. The pizza's good, but the burgers are just really, really great. Their website, you can check out the menu, thesquaredcircle.biz. Follow them on Twitter at the SQD Circle. Just great place to hang out. They've also got their events. Like, you can watch Monday Night Raw there. They've got pay-per-views. Every day has some kind of wrestling theme. At least 6 out of 7 days do. And you really get a personal touch. I would say Lisa thanks and hugs probably 80% or better of all the attendance of the Squared Circle in a given night.
Well, Kevin, I thank you so much for coming on the show. Your podcast has been a great addition to the PW Ponderings Network. You do a great job of promoting a lot of other people, so I'm glad you got to come on here and tell the people about yourself who may not know you from much outside the podcast or everything else. Because, again, I feel like there's a lot of times where you hear people on podcasts or you just see them on TV, but you don't get to really know the person behind that. So I'm glad we got to do that for you, and you got to come on here and talk about AEW and Shimmer. So appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Once again, I'd like to thank Kevin Harvey for coming on the show, sharing some of his knowledge, sharing his experiences in the world of professional wrestling, and of course for giving the nice plug to AAW and Shimmer this weekend. And again, just to give this weekend its due, I'm going to run through all the events you can go to. And I want to stress again that everything I'm about to list, all six events, all take place at the Berwyn Eagles Club at 6309 West 26th Street in Berwyn, Illinois. First up, Kevin Harvey hosts the next School of Everything Else session on Friday, October 18th from 4 to 6 p.m. It's a master's class. You learn about the development of a character with guest facilitator, Sweet Soraya Knight. You can, if you want to learn more information, you can go to the School's In Podcast, the School of Everything Else Wrestling on Facebook. You can also sign up for the class at cwrestling@gmail.com. That's seewrestling@gmail.com. You can also ask Kevin any questions on his Twitter at KevinHarveyAAW or give him a call at 630-708-6733. And again, that's all taking place before AAW's Hostile Intentions event that is going to be taking place also this Friday, the 18th, at the Berwyn Eagles Club. Bell time of 7:45, doors open at 7. Lots of really great matches on tap. You have the first and second round matches in the Allegiance Tag Team Tournament, which if you haven't seen the brackets, they're available on the AAW's Twitter page at AAW Pro. Check those out. Also, a rematch between AEW champion Shane Hollister and Eric Cannon, and a grudge match between AEW stalwart Merrick Brave and Christian Rose. Then, Saturday the 19th and Sunday the 20th, Shimmer Wrestling will be taking over Berwyn's Eagle Club for its taping of Shimmer's Volume 58 through 61. Volumes 58 and 59 are taped Saturday, and 60 and 61 are taped on Sunday. You can get tickets to all those events at shimmerwrestling.blogspot.com. All the tickets are available for pretty darned cheap, so be sure to check all of that out. And you can also follow them on Twitter at Shimmer Wrestling. As for me, follow me on Twitter at K413. Let me know what you think of this show, all the shows in general, the Fan to Fan podcast as a whole. I love hearing feedback, love feeding off of that and making the show better for you, because that's who it's for. Also, be sure to follow at PW Ponderings on Twitter. We will not be live tweeting results for AEW as we usually do, but we should have results before the AEW event and all of the Shimmer events on pwponderings.com. So if you unfortunately cannot make it to all the shows, you can at least see the results there. Also, be sure to listen to all the podcasts on PW Ponderings, like Kevin Harvey's Schools In podcast. Each week on Mondays, he talks to someone from the wrestling world. It's a very interesting podcast. Jerome Cuson hosts the interview show from time to time, interviewing people from the world of professional wrestling. And Chris GST and Des Delgadillo every week bring you the indie wrestling news roundup, all the news in independent professional wrestling, occasional guests from time to time, sometimes people from live shows or people on shows coming up. Another very good podcast. Over at WrestleFolks, you can listen to the head show WrestleFolks with Tom Green every Wednesday. And then you have the Nick Manawa and Reed Bentley variety show, which airs, I believe, usually on Thursdays. So be sure to check all those podcasts out. Lots of wonderful wrestling audio. And I do want to say that I know a month ago or so I said, oh, there's not going to be a show next week because we're doing a Cool Kids Table podcast. And that didn't come to pass, and I ended up doing another Fan to Fan. Well, I do believe this time that next week there will not be a fan-to-fan podcast with myself. I'm instead going to be doing the Cool Kids Table with Justin Houston and Brad Garoon, talking everything about Dragon Gate Pro Wrestling in Japan. Well, you can check that out exclusively at PW Ponderings. But fear not, I will be back on November 1st with a brand new, very long episode of Fan to Fan to make up for the time lost. So until then, enjoy the Cool Kids Table podcast over at PW Ponderings. Thank you very much for listening to this, and thank you for being a fan.